Case number 15-1344 et al., International Longshore and Warehouse Union et al. Petitioners versus the National Labor Relations Board. Mr. Vimar for the petitioners, Mr. Fritz, Amicus Curiae Pacific Maritime Association, Mr. Leroux for the respondent, Mr. Garone for the intervener, ICTSI Oregon Inc.
Now I'll say good morning.
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Robert Remar. On behalf of the petitioners, ILWU, may it please the court. By the way, I'm reserving 3 minutes for rebuttal. The board is the nation's expert in the administration of the National Labor Relations Act. However, in this case, what the board did was to expertly ignore governing Supreme Court precedent, this court's precedent, other Court of Appeals precedent, and it also ignored its own board precedent with respect to application of the issues in this case, namely work preservation issues in the longshore industry.
Why isn't the port in control? Why doesn't the whole case come down to that and the lease in Section 2.8 of the lease, the 2010 lease? Port's in control, lease preserves that. That's it. Simple case. They on page 31, I think of their brief, they call it a simple case. Usually when someone says that, I think it's not a simple case, but in this case, why isn't it a simple case?
Because you have to look at what the source of the control is. The port only has control of the container in the sense that any other entity along the line of the carrier's multi-port, multi-terminal trade road has access to the
who
container.
Who is giving the work assignments for the reefer's work? Who is doing it? Who is the person on the ground saying, you do it, you don't do it?
That's traditionally done.
Who's doing it here? Yeah.
Who does it here?
Yeah.
It was historically done by the port when the port served in the role of the terminal operator.
Right.
However,
and they
gave that up. They walked away from that. And they had that right of control through their stevedoring contracts with the carriers. As made clear in the ILA cases and this court's CalCartage.
I thought their argument was that in their lease with ICTSI, it made clear that they retained control over what had been done there traditionally.
The lease cannot control something that is held by the carriers and the PMA member companies. It's there.
So are the carriers the primary employer here?
The carriers are the primary
not
employer.
Not ICTSI?
ICTSI is also a primary employer. The collective employer group represented by the Pacific Maritime Association, they are the primary employer because they are the ones that are signatory with the ILWU. They are the ones that have control over the release of the containers, which is the essential element of control. If port or any other terminal doesn't comply with the directions of the carriers,
don't release their containers. Do you agree with the thrust of my colleague's question that the most important issue for us to resolve here is right of control? We don't really need to get into the complexities of work preservation, do we? If we determine, the first thing we've got to determine is who has the right to control.
I agree with that, Your Honor.
And if we disagree with you on the right, I mean, it really comes down to that. If we think the right to control was retained by Portland, there's no, you lose, right?
That is correct, Your Honor. Right. Yeah, under the two-pronged test.
Well, what is the standard of review that we apply to the board's decision on that?
Well, the standard of review is normally deferential, but it is not deferential with respect to the board's failure to even cite to the governing case law, the ILA cases, CalCartage, Bermuda Container.
If I understand your argument there, and I may not, so this is asking you for help here. If I understand your argument there, it's primarily over the way the board applied the work preservation doctrine in terms of whether this type of work had already been claimed before. So now, your argument, legal argument with them, is over the extent of the ability of the union to claim this work, right? And we can disagree with the board on that and still rule against you if we think the port retained control. That's what I'm getting at.
And I'm agreeing with you,
gotcha.
Your Honor.
Okay.
Yes, that's exactly right. That's what the case law lays out.
I'm not understanding still why the lease doesn't resolve the case. The 2010 lease in Section 2.8 where the ports, and you acknowledge the port traditionally controlled the work, and they enter into this lease in 2010 where they preserve, as I understood it, that work. ICTSI is not permitted to perform work that is defined as DCTU work as a result of that lease.
The reason is because the port in the first instance obtains possession and temporary control over the containers only by the carriers releasing the containers to the port. And that went on for several decades before the port got out of the business. Then the port removed itself from receiving the containers. It terminated its business contracts with the carriers. It assigned all of that over to ICTSI. And the port cannot...
When did it assign that over to ICTSI?
In May of 2010.
Right. But in doing so, it reserved, it had, I mean, what do we do with Section 2.8 of the lease, I guess?
Well, it is an invalid assertion of control when it doesn't exist. Just because you write in a lease, I have control over it, doesn't make it so, doesn't make it true. How does the board, what the board failed to do was look at what is the source, the original source of the port's control. It is the receipt from the carriers of the containers that are owned and controlled by the carriers. We have evidence in the record that the carriers are regularly overseeing and supervising the reefer work that's in dispute here. People are calling in to carrier representatives with respect to that. We have evidence that the carriers were very upset that the port wasn't complying with their directives on what to do with their own containers, and so the carriers threatened that they'd make alternative plans. They actually carried that out, went to other terminals, and as this court held in the ILA case, the one that went before the U.S. Supreme Court at 613 F2nd, that the withholding of the right to withhold the container is the ultimate manifestation of control. In those cases, and the Supreme Court noted this as well, that the containers were held at various points along the carrier's trade route by warehouse companies, by container freight stations, CFS, by trucking companies, and they had their own individual contracts that allowed all of these different entities with their own workforces to perform various duties concerning the carrier's containers. The carriers then, under the collective bargaining agreements that they had with the Longshore Union, then said, sorry, we're directing you to do it a different way per our contract. Well, this affected the obligations and the rights that the other warehouse companies and outside companies had with respect to their commercial agreements with the carriers. None of that mattered. None of it mattered because, as the courts found, the board found, the Fourth Circuit found, as well as this court, that the carriers, by virtue of being able to control the terms in which they release their containers, maintain control over them and over the work. The other thing to keep in mind in terms of the context of this is not a situation where it's just a one-stop operation at this one Terminal 6 in Portland. That's one way station along a long line of a single integrated trade route where the carrier is responsible from start to finish, including in the middle when it has a stop station at Terminal 6 for the transportation and the maintenance of its containers and its cargo. The conclusion that there is no control here is a conclusion that would allow port authorities, other landlords, other companies to basically preclude the longshore industry here from being able to negotiate work preservation agreements for even the traditional work that ILWU is performing today. If it's true that the port, because in the past it used to work on containers, still controls the containers, then there's no end to that control. Then they can tomorrow say it's not just the reefer work, it's going to be the loading of the reefers onto the ships. Why? Because we say so in our lease.
Your time is up. Did my colleagues have any more questions? We'll give you back 2 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Okay.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I'm Jonathan Fritz for the Pacific Maritime Association. Thank you for the opportunity to be heard today. PMA is the multi-employer bargaining agent that negotiates and administers labor contracts with the ILWU at every significant port along the Pacific Coast. We sought to participate as an amicus in this case because the NLRB's decision on both issues, the right to control issue and on the work preservation issue, creates problems for PMA in negotiating and administering its labor contracts, which is essential to promoting industrial peace on the West Coast. As Mr. Remar said, the board's decision ignores controlling Supreme Court precedent on both issues, the work preservation issue and the right to control issue. It also ignores this court's decision in California Cartage. The significance of the board's attempt to change the law on these two issues without any discussion of the controlling precedent transcends the facts of this case. It transcends the work at issue in this case, which is dockside reefer plugging and unplugging work at Terminal 6 in the Port of Portland, and it transcends the Port of Portland. These issues affect other work performed at other ports along the Pacific Coast, and it transcends the maritime industry, as it affects work preservation agreements in other industries where multi-employer bargaining is the norm.
What do you make of the question Judge Kavanaugh was posing about what are we supposed to do with the lease?
Well, in this court, in the California Cartage case, what this court held is the right to control analysis is not merely an analysis that looks to what contracts say. It is not a mechanical test, and that's in the court's decision in that case. You have to look at the circumstances of the dispute.
But certainly we look at the lease language itself, right?
Certainly not
and,
to say
and how do you read the lease language? What's the clear reading of the lease language is that work stays with the IBEW. You start there, right?
Correct. The court is certainly attempting to do that.
Okay.
But
so why didn't they do it in your estimation?
Because, first, the board has included the carriers in this coastwide bargaining unit for a reason, because the carriers have an interest in how work is performed on their containers when they go to a terminal. And in this case, the terminal is operated by a PMA member company. Both the carrier and the member have an obligation to ensure that their labor contract is enforced. The carrier has a commercial interest in how its cargo is handled. And I see no difference between, in the ILA cases, the carrier's interest in how cargo gets stuffed or stripped, loaded or unloaded, into a container. The right to control over that, which the Supreme Court held, the carriers have an interest for purposes of the right to control analysis in the loading and unloading of the container. How that is any different than the right to control the plugging in of that container when it's a refrigerated container, in order to preserve the contents of the cargo. The carrier has a commercial interest to make sure its cargo is handled in the appropriate way. And that interest gives it the right to control how that work is performed, whether the container even gets processed at the terminal. And then when the container arrives at the terminal, what is happening is the terminal operator is then doing the work of preparing the container to go on a ship, and the IBEW electrician is called over into the middle of that otherwise ILWU operation and is asked to simply plug in the container. There's really nothing else going on other than an IBEW electrician coming over and plugging in the container. The administrative law judge in this case found that what the IBEW is doing is smack in the middle of an otherwise ILWU marine clerk and longshore worker operation. So the problem we are faced with as the association is the law has been apparently changed without any guidance on either issue as to how it will be applied in the future. This is problematic for us as we negotiate contracts in the future.
Doesn't this seem, at least on the control issue, very fact-specific? Yeah. This lease, unless this is replicated in a lot of places, this kind of language and the circumstances of the 2010 lease, it would seem, on the control issue, fairly fact-specific.
It may be, but again, the implications are farther-reaching than that. And when we understand the law for over 30 years to be that the carriers have a right to control their containers, and the board then, without discussing that precedent, says, well, you don't have the right to control your containers just because the port asserts the right to have someone that they employ come over and plug in that container. I don't think...
So you're asking us, in fact, to disregard the language of the lease, to override it, override the deal that was struck between...
It is ultimately the carrier's container. And the carrier... Again, the NLRB ordered the carriers into the bargain unit in 1938 because the carriers have an interest in how the work is performed on the dock. So the carriers are in the unit precisely because they have an interest in how work gets performed on the docks.
Okay, great. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Good morning.
Good morning, Your Honors. Greg Lauro for the National Labor Relations Board, asking the court to enforce the board's orders because the board did reasonably find that this was unlawful secondary activity and that the work preservation defense failed. I agree with Your Honor's discussion this morning that this can be a simple case because it comes down to the fact-intensive issue of the port having the right to control. And if the court agrees with that or finds that substantial evidence supports the board's view of the lease and the surrounding circumstances as saying that, then the work preservation defense fails. I would point out it's not just the lease. It's the lease in the context of 40-year practice of assigning this work to the port electricians pursuant to the port's obligations under the DC-2 agreement, telling parties at the beginning of the lease negotiation process, even before ICSI's involved, we are going to preserve this.
But what do you make of the argument that the issue of control runs with ownership of the containers?
Well, I think it is too broad. I think, first of all, in the ILA cases, there isn't this broad holding that just because the carriers own the containers, they therefore control the right to assign work on those containers in any circumstances. The circumstances in the ILA and related cases were specific. Different records, different work, and most to the point, evidence of direct control over the assignment of the work by carriers. The carriers sometimes in those cases used their own labor to do the work on the containers or had the right to. We don't have those circumstances here. The port controlled the assignment of the work and has never relinquished that right. And I appreciate you also mentioned what I'll call the customer's primary or the bypass argument. I think the Ninth Circuit in the Hooks case already explained why that argument goes too far. It conflates mere ownership with the legal question of the right to control the assignment of work done on what you own. And I don't mean to be flip, but as we point out in the board's brief, I own my car. I take it to an auto shop. If I don't like the way they do the work, I can bypass and go to another auto shop. I can ask that they switch to another mechanic if I don't like the work. But my ownership of the car does not make me the direct employer with the right to control the work. And certainly, you couldn't picket me in a primary way if your dispute is with the auto shop. So I don't think there's much to that argument. I think the mere ownership argument would really expand law. And I also think, as you said before, it's that clear. We have evidence that the port is the party, that the entity that controls the work. Therefore, going after ICSI, which doesn't control the work, to get that work is a classic example of secondary activity. And I think that's very clear cut on the right to control issue. I understand there are other issues in this case, but if the court doesn't see an urgent need to get into them and has no further questions for me, I thank the court for its time.
Good morning.
May it please the court, Michael Garone for ICTSI Oregon. With me, I have my colleague and co-counsel, Peter Hurtgen, at council table. I would also like to focus my remarks on the right to control test, because as the ALJ, the board, the federal district court, and the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals in the 10L injunction case all held, the Port of Portland is the sole entity that controls the reefer work at T6. And even the ILWU in earlier stages of this proceeding agreed that at least between 1974 and 2008, the Port of Portland did control the reefer work. And I point to a section in the ALJ opinion, which was affirmed by the board at JA 2175, in which the ALJ quotes the ILWU's post-hearing brief as follows. Terminal 6 was not red-circled because at the time of the 2008 contract negotiations, the Port of Portland controlled the work as the terminal operator. And so even the ILWU has admitted in its previous statements in this proceeding that the Port of Portland did have control. They're saying that in 2008 something magically changed and control was wrested from them. But their argument here is a broader argument. Their argument here seems to be that the carriers always have controlled the work on their containers, that's inconsistent with what they said earlier in this case. So I think the ultimate issue under the right to control test is whether the pressured entity has the right to accede to the demands of the union. And if you apply that test to ICTSI, it's clear, I think, as just Judge Kavanaugh has recognized, that Article 2.8 gives ICTSI no power or ability to accede to the union's demands to have ILWU workers perform the reefer work. And additionally, I would submit that the ocean carriers also had no power or authority to accede to the union's demands to assign this work. And the evidence in this record is that the union demanded of the carriers and of ICTSI that this work be assigned to ILWU members. And the carrier's response was to contact the Port of Portland and ask the Port of Portland to release ICTSI from the obligations that were clearly enunciated under the lease agreement. That, I think, you know, is pretty strong evidence that the carriers did not have the right to accede to the union's demands. The proof is in the pudding. If they had the authority and the power to do it, they could have done it, and they were unable to do it. As far as the ILA cases and the California cartage case, again, the right to control is a factual question. Under the facts of those cases, and those cases, I believe, didn't really break new law or create new law on the right to control test or the work preservation doctrine, but they merely applied kind of a well-established test to specific factual circumstances. And in those cases, there was evidence in the administrative record below that the carriers sometimes did perform the reefer work with their own employees. Now here, the carriers have no employees at Terminal 6. They don't employ anyone. And so there's no record or history here that the carriers have ever performed this work or controlled this work themselves. The only evidence is the 38-year history of the Port of Portland's electricians performing the work at issue. In addition, if you look at the California cartage case, there was also evidence in that case that ILWU was employed stuffing and unstuffing containers at these freight transfer stations, so that went into the issue of whether there was a work preservation intent there. The California cartage case doesn't deal with the issue of right to control. So the right to control is a fact-intensive issue. It should be judged by this court under the substantial evidence test. And I would submit to the court that there's abundant evidence in this record based on the 38-year history that the Port of Portland controls the work. The Port of Portland supervises the work, and they pay the employees. They set the terms and conditions of employment. The fact that the carriers may set the temperature settings on the reefers doesn't mean they control the work. And I would, in closing, just ask the court to consider what the Ninth Circuit said about the ILWU's argument. The Ninth Circuit said that the argument that the ILWU is making conflates ownership of the containers with the power to assign the disputed work. And ownership of the containers does not give the carriers the right to assign this work at this terminal. Thank you.
Great. Thank you very much. Mr. Remar, I believe you used all your time, but we'll give you a minute back.
Thank you, Your Honor. In Cal Cartage, this court focused on the issue of right of control by virtue of ownership of the containers. They did so in the context of determining whether containers owned by non-PMA companies were actually sufficiently under the control of PMA companies. And the Cal Cartage case specifically held that ownership is the key to determining, ownership of the containers is the key to determining whether or not there's sufficient control here and who has the control, which is the carriers. The courts emphasized that there would be, quote, there would be no release of PMA containers to non-member companies, unquote, with respect to possible non-PMA containers. They were focusing on the ownership, and that's at pages 223 to 224 of that decision.
I believe your time is up, Mr. Remar. Thank you very much. The case is submitted.